Marshall, if you can call court to order, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Werke, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, February 4th, 2021. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have a number of cases set for oral argument as well as non-oral calendar. Our first matter for the oral calendar today is case number A20-0647, State of Minnesota versus Shane Kenneth Halverson. Before we begin, just a few housekeeping items. We are doing this via zoom.gov this morning. Thank you both for doing this virtually with us. We are recording this hearing. No other recordings are allowed without permission. So please, if anybody do not have any other recording, either audio or video or both. I just want to check with both parties to make sure that we can hear you okay. Counsel for appellant, if you could just speak up.
Good morning.
Okay, perfect. And counsel for respondent?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Okay, perfect. So, as you know, you will each have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so wish to use that. All other rules of the court apply, with exception that you do not have to worry about standing at all unless that's what you prefer. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Melissa Haley, and I represent Shane Halverson in this pretrial appeal out of the Stearns County District Court. We are asking the court to reverse Mr. Halverson's convictions for driving under the influence and also driving after cancellation, as they were based on evidence that should have been suppressed on the issues of the initial stop, the expansion of the stop, and whether or not there was probable cause when the judge authorized a search warrant for blood for my client. The facts are not disputed here. What we're asking you to do is to apply the law and find that the evidence should have been suppressed. So I'll talk about the first two issues somewhat together, because the test that you're looking at is the same for them. The initial stop and the expansion of their stop need to be justified by an objective totality of the circumstances, whether a reasonable officer would believe under these circumstances that he should have stopped the vehicle. And what the courts have required generally is that the officer be able to articulate in a court hearing the reasons that he stopped the person, and they need to be specific and individualized to that particular person. In this case, the Officer Raikana was pretty specific in his court, or in his court hearing, why he stopped Mr. Halverson. And he stated very clearly that he located the vehicle that matched the description and stopped it. And the description that he was referring to was the description on the suspicious person or trespass case that he was responding to. And that description of the vehicle was literally a black vehicle. There were no other
attributes. Ms. Haley, I think what your argument overlooks is the fact that when he found this car, or spotted this car, it wasn't like he spotted the car in Duluth or anywhere else in St. Cloud. He spotted the car in the area where this trespass had been reported. So what do we do with that?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because as I've been working on this issue and thinking about it, I think that the case that is instructive on what to do that is State versus Britton. And I'll come back to why I think that is. I'll address specifically the facts we know about the area in this case are that he was stopped at the intersection of Traverse Road and Roosevelt. And there is testimony that Roosevelt was a high speed road, a highway. So he was stopped at, or he was, the officer's attention was drawn to him at that intersection, right? What we know about where the suspicious activity happened was that it was on Allendale Drive. We don't have an address. We don't know where. And we don't have what courts have had in some of the other cases cited by a respondent, which is proximity, how close he was. So what we're left with is, if an officer says it was the exact area, is it the exact area? Is that all the court does for review, except that it's the exact area? Or do you look at what he said, what that means, what he said beyond that? And that's where I come back to State versus Britton. So that is a 2000 Supreme Court case. The officer stopped a car with a broken window, believing that it was a stolen car. And the officer testified that he had a lot of experience with investigating stolen cars, all of that kind of thing, that he truly personally believed that that car was stolen because the window was broken. But the court actually looked at what was said in the record and said that you need more than that, that that's actually his hunch. You can't, even if you're saying it's experience or whatever, you need to detail what specifically about this particular car made you think that this particular person was engaged in criminal activity.
Goes beyond just the car. You have a number of different facts here. You have the report of a person entering a home without permission, making some rather strange comments. You have a description of that person. You have a description of that car. You have the officer going to that vicinity. You have the officer running into hearing a report of a bicyclist seeing the car. You have the officer himself seeing the car and the person in the car that matches the description of the person who is alleged to have trespassed. And this is all within the vicinity of where the alleged trespass occurred. And this sounds a lot like the Smallwood case, the State v. Smallwood, where the Supreme Court said that the police had many reasons to suspect that Smallwood of it, because one, he was near the scene of the burglary; two, he was driving a car with headlights off; three, he fit the general description of the suspect; and four, he was agitated and excited. And actually, we have that as well. We have the observations from the officer that he was nervous, agitated, sweating, even though it was a relatively cool late August day. His pupils were dilated. So we have, actually, it seems like, even more facts here than we do in Smallwood, where they said, the Supreme Court said, there's more than enough information.
I think as you look at Smallwood, that was within 2 minutes. In this case, it looks like maybe it was closer, it was more like 10 minutes. That area was more, it was more defined where he was than it is here, right? We don't know exactly how far Officer Raikino was from where the actual event occurred. This wasn't, he saw the car pulling out of the driveway of where it happened, or saw it on the street. Officer Raikina in this case also testifies he didn't see anything else unusual about the officer. And I think the details as to nervousness, this officer testified he did not think Mr. Halverson was nervous when he stopped him. He specifically asked him, and he did not think that he was nervous when he testified he didn't think he was nervous when he stopped him.
Well, how do you get around the description of the car and the description of the driver? Those two matching right there seem to me to be enough right there. It matches it. You said it's within 10 minutes versus 2 minutes. That's still a lot different than going there an hour later or looking through another city. That's still a relatively short period of time. It still seems like that's, even though we don't know the exact location, that's within the vicinity. But you know, if an officer sees somebody driving a certain car and fits a certain description, that seems to be enough for them, and a reported criminal activity. Articulable suspicion is a relatively low bar.
I would go back to what the officer actually testified, and it's at the transcript at page 8 to 9, page 21 and 33 and 34, where he talks specifically about, I stopped him because it was a trespass. And he says, I stopped him because I located the vehicle that matched the description. He also talks about how he did match the description of white male, short hair, black shirt, but I don't think it's at all clear from this record that he knew that before he stopped him. I think this record indicates he stopped him because it was a black car, and as he said, in the exact area.
Ms. Haley, I'm going to attempt to pin you down on something in your brief that you seem to own up to today. In your brief, you're arguing that there wasn't any direct testimony to support that this was like a 10-minute time period that passed from the strange person entering the house, the trespass complaint, and being pulled over. You're acknowledging that there was testimony by the officer that this was within a 10-minute range?
I don't think the officer actually said
that. Well, he didn't actually say, but they talk in that officer talk, that 24-hour time clock. I'll never, ever figure that out in my head. But I mean, he did testify. He said, I did this at, I don't know, whatever time it was.
Right.
And then he did this at whatever. So that's certainly that. We can do our math. That adds up to be 10 minutes or less.
I am okay with being pinned down on that.
Ms. Haley, if I may, I understand your arguments on the reasonable suspicion for the initial stop, but if this court were to say, okay, we think there was reasonable suspicion for the initial stop, doesn't that take care of the other issues that you talk about in the expanded stop? I mean, let me kind of put this out and you tell me where you think I'm wrong. Because if there's a reasonable suspicion for the initial stop, then verifying his ID by running it through it, that's not an expansion, that's tied to the initial stop, right? Then you find out his license was canceled, he's arrested, then there's a search incident to the arrest. I mean, so doesn't it really all come down to whether there's a reasonable suspicion for the initial stop, other than your the warrant issue?
I think that, well, yeah, I think Askaruth is the case that talks about the incremental intrusion and having to have reasonable suspicion for every stage beyond the initial stop. And our position is, as we talked about in the brief, that we don't think it's there. So I'm not agreeing fully with what you're saying, but I do hear you. It does tie to the first stop. And then if you can tie everything back to the first stop under Askaruth, to the trespass, then yes. But in this case, we believe that the DWI investigation was different than the trespass, and that needed its own reasonable articulable suspicion to go down that road. Does that answer your question?
In part.
Okay.
I'm gonna let you get back to your argument.
All right. Thank you. I actually would like to talk a little bit about the search warrant issue before I run out of time here. In that case, you know, the first two issues are de novo review. The search warrant issue is a more deferential standard because we want to encourage people to get search warrants. I think what's salient in this case is that the judge at the time they had the documents to review, in the documents, there wasn't anything specific about driving conduct. It was the suspicious activity and the fidgety, sweating, and shaking, the physical indicia, and then also the results of the one field sobriety test that the officer did related to the eyes. And the position here is that that's not a substantial basis. Maybe a basis, a signing judge at a court reviewing quickly, you can see why they might have signed this. But as you look back, substantial basis is a fair probability that there was the impaired driving and that this warrant was going to lead to evidence of that criminal offense. And on this record, we just don't think there was enough to authorize the search warrant in this case. State versus Fawcett is a Supreme Court case that was reviewing a search warrant in an alcohol and a controlled substance case. That case, I think, explains well that really limiting yourselves to what the affidavit actually said and what the judge knew at the moment that they were reviewing the search warrant, and not all of these other pieces that we know beyond that, but what that judge had in that moment making the decision in this case. And at the end of the day, what all of these issues go back to is the reasonableness and the government intrusion versus the individual's right to be free from that intrusion. I mean, I think with the search warrant, when it's a search for blood, and our legislature has actually come up with the statute, this is important enough, we're also gonna tell you that you have to follow these things statutorily. I think we really need to be cautious about when we allow officers to get that warrant ahead of the DRE evaluation and those types of things. Because on this affidavit, you just don't have the level of certainty you need for the warrant. It's perhaps reasonable suspicion, but it's not to that next level of fair probability you need for the warrant.
So Ms. Haley, you did acknowledge in your arguments that you could understand why a issuing magistrate would issue this. And the standard, like you said, is very deferential to the point that we look at things and resolve any doubtful or marginal cases with the deference of giving preference to the issuance of a warrant. So why wouldn't we do that here, given your acknowledgement that, yeah, you can understand why an issuing magistrate would allow for the search warrant, approve it?
Two pieces to the response. One is, I meant as courts are reviewing a lot of documents, you're not able to look as they're not able to look as closely at some of these things. So I didn't mean to say I concede that there's enough there. I mean to say that in the frenzy to get things done and out and let people act on it, I think that it's possible that there was not. That they made a mistake, basically, in this case. And then the second piece, the deference to the warrants, I think, is where it's right at the line. Not that, right, you still have to look and make the inquiry that there was a substantial basis. There was more than a basis, it was substantial. There was enough there that it was a fair probability that there was evidence of impairment and that they would find it if they executed this warrant.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hale, and you'll have time for rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. We're here today on the three issues counsel just articulated. Number one, the lower court determined that there was sufficient.
And counsel, if I could stop you for a second, if you could just make sure to introduce yourself and the party you're representing.
Thank you, Your Honor. My apologies. Yes, I'm Nathan Knornchild, and I represent the state of Minnesota, specifically Stearns County, in this matter. The three issues before the court, as just articulated, are was the lower district court correct in affirming the stop of the motor vehicle? Was the district And I apologize, I'm getting notifications to admit people to the from the waiting room. I hope I'm not.
Yeah, don't worry.
Ignore that. Okay.
We'll take care of that. Yep.
Also, was the expansion of the stop, was the district court correct in affirming the expansion of the stop, and was district court correct in determining there was probable cause to issue the search warrant in this matter? And I put to your honors that the district court's determination was correct in all of these. In going to the first issue, I do want to address something that was brought up in the respondents or appellants, my apologies, reply brief. And that is that this notion that number one, the district court didn't rely upon the bicyclist complaint in determining that the stop was valid. And two, that somehow the parties had agreed or stipulated that that we would only be looking at what the district court determined and justified the how it justified the stop based upon the fact that this was a stipulated trial on stipulated evidence rather. So first off, in looking at the district court's order, it's just not true that The district court paid no mention to the bicyclist's report of almost getting hit by the defendant in his car. The district court does state that the, focus primarily on the trespass report and from the complainant, the original report, but then it also says that the bicyclist report further strengthens the basis for the stop. So that was a factor that the district court looked at. And second of all, in terms of whether the stipulation that resulted in a trial by stipulated evidence, there was no discussion that the Court of Appeals wouldn't review these issues de novo. That is, in terms of the stop and the expansion of the stop, the standard of review is de novo, and there's no mention of any kind of limitation on that. So, in looking at this issue, there is plenty to justify the basis for the stop. As has been pointed out, Officer Rikana had the description of the vehicle, color of the vehicle, I should say, the person driving it, a white male with short hair and a white t-shirt, and he does testify that he stopped that person in the exact area. There was a mention of that we don't know the addresses involved here, but we do. Exhibit 1, which was introduced at the contested omnibus hearing, contained the police report in this matter, and it just states that the complainant called from 2 Allendale Drive in the city of St. Cloud, and the stop occurred at Clearwater Road and 22nd Street, I believe. So we know that those two areas. I would ask, we did not go into extreme detail about the distances between those two areas at the contested omnibus hearing, probably because it was a courtroom full of people from St. Cloud and we weren't thinking about how that was going to look in St. Paul. However, I'd ask the court to take judicial notice that those two locations are a mile apart on the road, and as the crow flies, much less than a mile apart. So, and then again, Officer Rikana testified that he was at the exact area where the complaint came from when he stopped the individual. So that was part of his testimony. In addition, I believe this case does follow much more closely with Waddell and Smallwood, in that Officer Rikana had a lot to go on in this matter, much more so than we've seen in other cases where officers have stopped someone just because they were in the area, stopped a car just based upon the number of people in it and the color of it and the general description of it. He had the somewhat description of the car. It was a car, not a truck. It was a black car. And he had the description of the individual. So I would ask that you affirm the district court's decision on the stop being a valid stop in this matter. Moving on to the expansion of the stop, I don't see this as an issue at all. The officer ran the defendant's identification, as the court pointed out, and noticed that his driver's license was canceled as integral to public safety. And taking him into custody and doing a search incident to arrest, they found marijuana and a pipe on his person. And then the officer had, prior to that, also noticed in speaking with him the fidgetiness, the nervousness, the profuse sweating. So it all built upon itself. And the field sobriety tests weren't conducted until the marijuana had already been found on him. So at that point, the officer had the strange behavior at the house. He had the bicyclist report, so driving conduct. And then he had the physical observations of the driver, as well as the marijuana being found on his person. So I'd ask that the court also affirm the lower court, the district court's decision in that respect as well. If I could just to also touch about this report here, which is also always kind of seemed so odd to me, that the initial report wasn't just someone is in my house and they left. It was someone is in my house and they're looking for Crystal, who is in trouble, and then they fled the scene when they are confronted on that. And there's some discussion in the appellant's brief that they might have just walked into the wrong house and then they left when they found out that they were in the wrong house. But that behavior doesn't match up when it's noted that they've talked about Crystal being in trouble. I suppose it's possible if someone walks into the wrong house, I've never done it, but it could happen, and then they're confronted by that, I would expect a normal response is they apologize and leave. However, the fact that he stated he was looking for Crystal, who was in trouble, they wouldn't just leave at that point. They would try and ascertain where Crystal is. Is there a Crystal that lives around here looking for someone who's in trouble? They don't just flee the scene. And we know that they just fled the scene because we also have the bicyclist report. And I guess I would go back and touch on that. In addition to all of the physical descriptions that were provided the officer and the stop, and I glossed over this, but the bicyclist report alone is enough to justify the stop of the motor vehicle. That is an independent allegation of a violation of the law, whether it's careless driving or not giving a bicyclist enough room on the road when you pass them. That alone is enough for Officer Rikkonen to have stopped the car. There was some discussion in the briefs about the bicyclist being anonymous and not being identified, but I'll rely on the cases that I cite in my brief to justify that, that's really a non-issue. When it's a face-to-face identification or report, then there is no need for identification of the complainant in those situations. Finally, the third issue would be the search warrant in this matter. And counsel and your honors have pointed out that this is not a de novo review. The courts give great deference to the lower courts when they issue search warrants. Obviously, we want to encourage officers to acquire search warrants. And case law is clear that not only do we give them great deference, but in close situations, we defer to the lower courts. And those are really two separate issues. The counsel stated in her argument that deference to the warrant is only in close cases, but I don't believe that's what the case law says. Appellate courts are to give great deference to the district courts when they issue these search warrants and magistrates. And also, in close cases, we defer to the lower courts and we defer to search warrants being valid. So those are really two separate standards in my mind. In terms of the search warrant, I think, and I cited in my brief, the State v. Prax, which I think is, it's not a search warrant case, it's dealing with probable cause for arrest, but I would argue that's a higher standard. And the facts in State v. Prax are very similar to what we have here, and the court upheld an arrest based upon those facts. So in State v. Prax, they had driving conduct, there was a vehicle incident. We don't have driving, but we have some driving conduct. It's not in the search warrant, but we do have suspicious behavior, which I would argue is akin to that. So we have this entering another person's home, looking for crystal, which is in trouble. So the extent that driving, that someone's conduct in driving is indication of impairment, I would argue so too is this highly suspicious behavior going into someone's home. In State v. Prax, the defendant passed some field sobriety tests and failed others' field sobriety tests. Here, the search warrant tells us that the field sobriety tests, the only ones that were offered, were failed. The horizontal gaze nystagmus and the vertical nystagmus were both failed. The horizontal with respect to the left eye only, but as Officer Rikkonen testified to, a vertical nystagmus is an indication of impairment from a narcotic controlled substance rather than alcohol. And it's significant that both of those were present in both, or that was present in both eyes in this case. And then in State v. Prax, the court noted that the defendant had eyelid and body tremors. Here, the officer noted in his application that the defendant was visibly shaking. So again, that's very similar. In Prax, the defendant was noted to be sweating, and here the defendant was also noted to be sweating. And then in State v. Prax, the arrest was based upon anxious, fidgety behavior. And here the search warrant noted that the defendant also exhibited fidgety behavior. The only differences were that in State v. Prax, the officer noted that the defendant had dilated pupils and an elevated pulse and swayed, which are not present in the search warrant in this matter. But again, the search warrant standard is much less than probable cause to arrest. We're simply looking for a substantial basis to conclude that this search warrant would result in uncovering additional evidence of wrongdoing. And if there's a fair probability that it would find contraband, then it's a valid search warrant. And I would argue that based upon the factors that we've seen here and that are listed in the search warrant, the assigning judge had more than enough to determine that this was going to, that there's a fair probability this would result in additional evidence of impaired driving. And I guess, you know, Your Honors, that's all I have. I feel remiss to leave any time. Are there any questions for me at this point?
Doesn't look like there are any questions for you. Thank you very much, Mr. Knorchild. We'll now turn it back to counsel for appellant. Ms. Haley, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to briefly address the argument, respondent arguments related to the bicyclist. First of all, that it is a de novo standard of review, but you review the facts for clear error, and the judge made a specific finding that the driving conduct relative to the bicyclist wasn't the basis for this. So for what that's worth. The second point is the respondent is arguing that the driving conduct itself could be a violation of statutes that he cited in his brief and talked about again today, and that by itself could be a basis to stop. And we filed a reply brief on that, and it's pretty clear in the law that officers can decide to stop for a traffic violation if when they observe it in particular, but that situations where it's a tip like this, even assuming that whatever the person described was amounted to a traffic violation, that is not, that tip is not necessarily enough either. And the case that I would cite you to is Olson versus Commissioner of Public Safety, 1985 Supreme Court case where they reversed on a tip. And one of the reasons they look at reliability, one of the reasons they reversed in that case was that the complaint was for erratic driving. The person who gave the information gave their license and there was a way to track them. But the police officer himself had not seen that driving conduct. And so that was not a basis. So for the reasons in our reply brief and that additional case, just not true that the traffic violation or the driving conduct or however you characterize it of the comments of the unknown bicyclist would be a basis by themselves to uphold this stop. And finally, I go back to the initial stop argument. And I want to touch briefly on the comments about Waddell and Smallwood again. Waddell talked about, well, first of all, the interest in that case was in solving a murder and a robbery at a mini mart, not a suspicious activity that may or may not be a trespass. And the attributes of that car, the description of that car, were many more than the one attribute of color here. There was the make and model of the body, the description or condition of the car, and those are all things that made it more reasonable for an officer to stop a car that matched the condition and all of those details. The same thing with the physical description in Waddell. It was not just race, hair, length, and t-shirt or shirt color. It was age. It was comparison of heights between the different people in the car. It was noticeable facial features, the facial hair, that kind of a thing. So there was just a lot more to those descriptions in those cases. Finally, on the stop issue, even if there are other cases that you could say, well, it's close to this or that, at the end of the day, according to Britton in our case law, it's what this officer actually said in the moment. And what I come back to what we started with, which is he located the vehicle that matched the description, which was the black color. It's not clear from this record. He knew this was a white male until he went to the door of the car and saw that it was a white male. The state has the burden of showing that under the totality of the circumstances, an objective, reasonable officer would have made this stop, would have believed that this particular person was the person involved in the trespass or the suspicious activity that he was investigating. And on this record, we believe that they have not met that burden. Same goes for the search warrant issue. The burden is on the state to prove that in the under all the circumstances in this case, that there was a substantial basis when the judge signed that warrant, and we don't think they've met that burden as well. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you both for your time and your arguments, very well argued and briefed as well. We appreciate that. We'll be issuing an order within the statutory timeframe, which here would be 90 days. Thank you both. And